Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. For the past decade, Brenda Sherburn LaBelle has dedicated her life to taking care of one of the tiniest and most fragile birds on Earth, orphaned baby hummingbirds. One wrong move could instantly kill these delicate creatures. The story of Brenda and two tiny orphans, Maya and Zuni, are the subjects of a new book by best-selling author and naturalist Cy Montgomery. The Hummingbird's Gift, Wonder, Beauty, and Renewal on Wings, chronicles the lightest birds in the sky. They fly backwards, dive at speeds of 61 miles per hour, and beat their wings more than 60 seconds a second. They are also vulnerable when they are born, and that is where Brenda Sherburn LaBelle comes in. Cy Montgomery writes, quote, "Baby hummingbirds require constant, diligent, round-the-clock attention. They tax even their mothers, who may make more than 100 flights a day to find food for their babies. Even with Brenda's decade of experience, we knew we were no match for a mother hummingbird. We would have to work even harder and longer to make up for that. Saving those tiny babies was a big task. But the rewards, as I was to learn, were even bigger," end quote. Cy Montgomery is a naturalist, documentary scriptwriter, and author of 20 acclaimed books of nonfiction for adults and children, including the National Book Award finalist, The Soul of an Octopus, and the memoir, The Good, Good Pig, a New York Times bestseller. Cy Montgomery is also the recipient of a number of honors, including Lifetime Achievement Awards from the Humane Society and the New England Booksellers Association. Her new book is called The Hummingbird's Gift, Wonder, Beauty, and Renewal on Wings. Hi, Cy. Thank you so much for writing this beautiful book, and thank you for joining us.
I'm so thrilled to share it with you.
We're also joined today by Brenda Sherburn LaBelle, an artist, sculptor, and hummingbird expert. Brenda is one of a small handful of volunteer wildlife rehabilitators willing and qualified to take on such a time-consuming, meticulous job. She's worked with WildCare for a decade. WildCare delivers world-class medical care in an open-admission wildlife hospital. They also focus on environmental education, community engagement, and effective advocacy for the protection of wildlife and our shared habitat. WildCare is based in San Rafael, California. Hi, Brenda. Thank you so much for joining us. Cy, let's start off with you. This book is so beautiful. I'm a huge fan of your work. I love The Soul of an Octopus, and The Good, Good Pig is still on my list. And what a pleasure to have you. And so I'm definitely going to start that one soon. How much did you know about hummingbirds before meeting Brenda?
Not much. But one thing I did know, which was what really interested me, and that is that, you know, all birds really are made of air. And, you know, their bones are hollow. Their feathers are mostly made of air. Most birds' feathers weigh more than their skeletons. But the bird that best illustrates this aspect of birdiness is the hummingbird. I mean, of which there's 330 species. But I knew that they embodied the idea of fragility that gives them a superpower. And what could be more fragile, more vulnerable, more amazing than a baby hummingbird? And so I actually went looking for somebody who was a rehabilitator who could help heal orphaned baby hummingbirds. And Brenda is an angel. And I met her in New England over 10 years ago. And she's the one who walked me through this amazing miracle of helping these two orphaned infants survive and eventually grow up to rule the sky.
Oh, Brenda, I hear you laugh. I'm so glad you're there now.
Yes, I'm here. Cy is just over the top when she, like, there's a lot of rehabbers like me out there, and we just worked it, you know, day by day. I think I was really happy that Zuni and Maya got their own little book. Oh, yeah. It was so exciting.
Well, it's amazing to learn about these incredible creatures. And Brenda, just to learn about the meticulous work that goes into rehabilitating them, how did you begin this work?
I really didn't know a whole lot about birds. It's kind of interesting. I received, because of my art background, I received a grant, a fellowship to go down to Belize and build an exhibit for the Audubon, for the Belize Audubon down there. And when I was down there, that's when I really learned about birds and hummingbirds, as well as all the other incredible migrating birds. They're in the path, all the Oregon, the Ohio birds kind of go down that way. And then I went home. That was in 2001, and I got home, and 9/11 hit. And it just devastated me. And I just wanted to do something to make the world a better place. So I went to Wild Care and I said, I want to foster care a bird. I want to, you know, really do it seriously and on a team or something. And I don't care what bird. And I was just lucky that Ingrid, this incredible hummingbird person, said, I want you on my team. And she was a hummingbird person, and she just took me under her little wing and taught me everything I needed to know. And it was a pretty heavy duty teaching thing she gave me. Before she would even let me have a little baby bird. And that was the beginning. And it was strange because, you know, my art background and then working and doing the arts and learning about the birds in Belize, and then coming back and this whole incredible, it's like my little volunteer job kind of just overwhelmed, just kind of took over. And I had the most exciting next decade, or about 14 years, probably 12, 14 years, with training other people and everything, of this experience with hummingbirds that changed my life. And so...
Well, it's an incredible story. And before we talk about the two hummingbirds that you write about, Maya and Zuni, let's just talk about some basic facts about hummingbirds, because so many of us love these creatures. But to learn all of these incredible things about these birds, Sai, as you write, they're the lightest birds in the sky. They're capable of flying backwards, which is amazing to even think about, diving at speeds of 61 miles per hour and beating their wings more than 60 times a second. First off, flying backwards. I mean, I love watching the slow motion videos of hummingbirds because you just wonder, how are they able to fly that fast? But to think about them flying backwards.
I know. Until the invention of the stroboscope, no scientist had any idea how hummingbirds do it. And in fact, their scientific name of the group, the family of hummingbirds, translates to the words no feet, because it was believed at one point that they never landed. So who needed any feet?
And what else can you add on that, Brenda? Just the incredible things that these tiny, delicate creatures are capable of.
The backwards and upside down, when you see them kind of do these big circular things and all of that, just really blows you away. They're like a circus bird. I mean, they're delightful to watch. I mean, they're just... when you see them, you just kind of dead in your tracks. It's like, wow. And so, you know, I, they symbolize joy, and it's really easy to know why.
Yeah, they used to be called resurrection birds. The mm-hmm. Spanish, when they first came to South America and saw these birds, they actually thought, well, these birds must die every night and be made new every day, because otherwise, how could they glitter so gloriously? So they've always been, you know, associated with superpowers, but their superpowers are real. Like, as you pointed out, Rose, you know, if you compare a male Allen's hummingbird to the space shuttle, if in terms of body length, a male Allen's hummingbird, when he's showing off to a female, bests the space shuttle as it screams down through the Earth's atmosphere. It screams down at 207 shuttle body lengths per second, but the Allen's hummingbird can dive 385 body lengths per second.
Wow.
And, you know, they had just this furious pace of their lives. They breathe like 250 times a minute. Their heart beats 500 times a minute. A hummingbird needs to visit about 1,500 flowers and eat 600 to 700 insects every single day just to fuel this incredible pace of life.
It's also wild to think about hummingbirds. They're made of air. As you write, their tiny bodies are crammed with no fewer than 9 air sacs, in addition to their 2 huge lungs and enormous heart. So that's also really interesting. Can you tell us more about that, Cy? Hummingbirds are made of air?
Yeah, that's why I was so interested in hummingbirds, not just because they're so beautiful, but because they are really just bubbles fringed with feathers. And this is what gives them all of their superpowers and allows them to shoot like a flaming atom at these incredible speeds and hover and fly backwards, etc. But it makes them incredibly difficult to care for. Because you try to give them a shot and you could hit an air sac and puncture an air sac, essentially giving them pneumothorax, a punctured lung. Just touching them with your finger can damage their feathers. Their little feet are as thin as embroidery thread. And feeding them, well, Brenda showed me how you feed them. You feed them with a syringe. It looks like you're making them swallow a sword. Mm-hmm. And you're just so scared to do this. I was just petrified to do it the first time. But if you don't feed them every 20 minutes, they'll starve to death. But if you feed them too much, because they literally are just bubbles, they literally are made of air, they, like a bubble, will pop.
Well, that's the other thing that was so interesting to learn about, Brenda. If you're going to take on this incredible task of trying to rehabilitate hummingbirds, you have to really be on it. It's not like you can go away for the day, because you have to be there every 20 minutes. So can you talk a little bit more about that, just how intense this work really is?
Yeah, I can. You know, I just wanted to make a comment. When you hold a hummingbird in your hand, it's like you have to peek in your hand and make sure it's still there, because it really has no weight. And with its little feathers, you barely know it's really there. It's like a magical, and like, there it is. yeah, we have a real hard time finding reliable people that can really stick with foster caring baby hummingbirds, because it is a real commitment. But, you know, you can adjust. I mean, it's, you know, I had a little basket. I just took them everywhere I went, and I had a little beeper thing, a little timer on my, like a little necklace, and it would go beep. And I just opened up the little basket, and it only took a second, and they're very good at gaping. And they just like open up wide and you just give them a little drop and that's it. But they went to the grocery store, any place I went, you know, they were just there. And people, I was working, in an office for when I first got back from Belize and I had the baby hummingbirds and all of this. I would go to meetings and I'd just have that little basket and people just thought it was like a purse or something. And my little beep, just one little beep, and I would just feed the baby, and nobody even in the meeting would even know that I had them. I mean, it's not like some baby birds will do a lot of peeping and make a lot of noise, but baby hummingbirds, they don't do that. So, but it is a commitment. I mean, the reality of really having to have them with you every moment, and that you can't leave them, is pretty challenging. And that's why I think the training, you know, it's such a long training before they'll actually let you have a bird, because they have to, because if you miss a couple feedings, that bird, the baby bird, is dead. So, and that's not very long time.
Well, that is Brenda Sherburn LaBelle, who is one of a handful of volunteer wildlife rehabilitators willing and qualified to take on such a time-consuming, meticulous job. Brenda has worked with WildCare for a decade. They're based in San Rafael, California. They deliver medical care in an open admission wildlife hospital. And we'll talk more about WildCare. There is a link on our website if you'd like to learn more about this incredible organization, YourCallRadio.org. Cy Montgomery is a naturalist documentary scriptwriter and author of 20 incredible books of nonfiction for adults and children, including the amazing book, The Soul of an Octopus, and the memoir, The Good, Good Pig. Cy's latest book is The Hummingbird's Gift, Wonder, Beauty, and Renewal on Wings. And if you have any questions for Brenda or Cy about hummingbirds, if you have any experiences you'd like to share, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk a little bit about human interaction with hummingbirds, because so many people have hummingbird feeders. And Cy, it was so interesting to learn in the book that too often people, quote, rescue babies prematurely. If the babies are alone, they assume the nest is abandoned. But in order to feed her baby, a mom must leave the nest 10 to 110 times a day. And so WildCare staff tell people, if they call in, to watch the nest for at least 20 minutes to make sure the babies are really abandoned. This was so interesting to learn about.
Yeah, it's true with other birds as well. There's a hilarious video out by a guy who's a wildlife rehabber telling people, if you see a baby bird on the ground, don't necessarily rescue it. It's a baby bird on the ground. If it's a nestling, you can replace it in the nest and it won't be, you know, the parents don't smell you on it and they don't freak out. They'll be visibly delighted to be reunited with their baby. But if it's got feathers, I mean, it may be on the ground because it's looking for some worms. So many times, good-hearted people rescue animals that just need to be left alone.
Brenda, what would you add to that? You say that people find a hummingbird nest and then they panic. The problem is, people don't realize that the mom could be out finding food, and so few people will sit still and just watch for about 20 minutes.
Yeah, most people, I've come to think that humans have a very short attention span. I mean, to sit there and watch a hummingbird, hummingbirds are fast. They come in and they feed that baby, and then they're gone out there to get more bugs to feed the baby the next time. I mean, if you glance away from that nest when you're when you're watching, you can miss it. And you know, it's very hard to convince a person when you're talking to them on the phone that they have to really stay there and really watch the nest very, very closely to see that mother bird feed the baby. When the birds fledge and they do fledge to the ground, it really matters where you are at. If you're in an urban area, I probably would say if you're right there watching the bird for a while and it doesn't kind of fly up into a bush or a tree or something, I'd probably pick it up and take it into a rehab center, because there's so many domestic cats out there, and that's one of the big predators for a lot of baby birds, but especially for baby hummingbirds. And there's not always in urban areas little bushes and things for the birds to like hide in, and when they first fledge, if they're like right on the sidewalk or on the road or beside a house or something, and sometimes it is dangerous, so you have to kind of use some common sense, and because it really varies where you live, how safe it is for the birds. So
well, that's such a good point, Brenda, because I was amazed. If you go into any wildlife rehabber and look at the reason why a bird has been brought into rehab, the most common reason is abbreviated CBC, caught by cat. Mm.
Right. You write about that. That it was hard to also learn that in addition to hummingbirds being killed by pets, cats, so many of them actually die.
God, it's amazing they can live at all. You know,
right.
You think everybody eats them. I mean, fish can jump out of the water if the nest is hanging over the water and gulp a hummingbird. Praying mantids can eat them. I mean, it's horrifying. Yellow jackets can sting them to death. And plus, there's a host of horrible things that we do, probably the worst of which, well, Brenda, you could tell me, but is spraying insecticide on your lawn. I mean, it really should be called avicide. If you want to get rid of all your birds, just spray insecticide around and everybody will die. First, it gets rid of the bugs that birds need. Very few people realize that hummingbirds don't just sip nectar. They need hundreds of bugs to survive. The babies need hundreds of bugs to survive. And if you kill all the food, you know, just having the hummingbird feeder out there isn't going to take care of all of their needs. It's like giving them frozen Snicker bars and no rice and beans. You know, they need that protein. And it also will poison the birds themselves. They're full of lungs. I mean, they're made out of air. And if you spray poison in the air, it's going to be inside the birds.
Mm. Yeah, it's really a horrible, horrible using. And you know, up north where I'm working now, you know, the county sprays along the side of the roads for I guess, I don't know, to kill bugs and invasive bugs, I guess, that they think of damaging things. But what by doing that, they're really doing big damage to all the pollinators and birds and little critters even. And so we have to post, you know, all along the road, no do not spray insecticides, do not, you know, and we have these little signs with big ladybugs on them and honeybees and stuff. So the state won't spray our by our property and stuff. But so I think that right up to, it's not just, common people buying something at their hardware store or their gardening store, but there needs to be some real strong legislation done for protecting wildlife a lot more in our with our government, so they don't do that kind of thing.
Amen, Brenda.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Brenda Sherburn-Labelle is a hummingbird rehabilitator. She's worked with WildCare for a decade. They deliver medical care in an open admission wildlife hospital in San Rafael, California. And we meet Brenda and two tiny orphans, Maya and Zuni, in the new book by bestselling author and naturalist Cy Montgomery. It's called The Hummingbird's Gift, Wonder, Beauty, and Renewal on Wings. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with award-winning journalist Gerald Posner about how big pharma has profited during the pandemic. He says they've see COVID as a once in a generation business opportunity. Vaccine profits have created at least 9 new billionaires with a combined $19 billion, enough to fully vaccinate 780 million people in low income countries. I hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. Today we are celebrating and learning about hummingbirds with Cy Montgomery, author of the beautiful new book, The Hummingbird's Gift, Wonder, Beauty, and Renewal on Wings, and Brenda Sherburn-Labelle, who is a hummingbird rehabilitator. She's worked with WildCare for a decade. They're based in San Rafael, and you can learn more about them at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments for Brenda or Cy, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. As sort of background, I am a site manager for a community art center in Hayes Valley, and we have a really big garden. And I'm just wondering about what kind of plants can I throw in there for the hummingbirds. And let me also mention that when I'm out watering, they like to fly into the stream and give themselves a little bath. It's really
cute. Oh, nice.
Well, thank you for that question. Brenda, do you want to take that one first?
So you have an art center, you said?
Oh, it's a garden. It's a community garden.
A community garden.
In a San Francisco neighborhood.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, there's a lot of I don't know if you have room for planting any trees where you are in your community garden, but if you, it's nice if you can have a hedgerow of some sort of for pollinators, like a dogwood tree or something that. Kind of blossoms. The hedgerows blossom very, very early in the spring when there's not very much going on. And they really kind of get the bees and the hummingbirds start migrating through and all of that kind of going. You should maybe look into a hedgerow if you have the space. If not, you know, there's plenty of different types of shrubs and flowers you could do. Down in the Bay Area, the bottle brush is a nice big shrub that the hummingbirds just love, and so don't the other pollinators. And they have the echium, those beautiful echiums, those purple echium. And the bees love that as well as the hummingbirds. I kind of go with them, and then penstemons and salviers, any salviers they like, but that's later in the summer. I think when you're planting for the pollinators, especially hummingbirds and that, you need to think seasonal and try to put things in that kind of for all the different seasons, and then you get the migratory birds as well as the local ones that are there, because you get the in the Bay Area you have the anners there all year round, and you'll attract a lot more birds. I always put out a big ball of nesting material too to help them nest, and that's great in the community gardening. You'll get more hummingbirds nesting. Is that helpful?
Yes, very helpful. Cy, I wanted to ask you, since we're talking about what people should do to create gardens to bring in hummingbirds, and this also we can add bees and other creatures. We've done a lot of shows about that. You write about the danger that these creatures are facing. Honeybees are suffering from colony collapse disorder. Bumblebee populations are crashing. You're 50% likely to see a bumblebee than you were in 1974. Butterfly populations have decreased. I mean, on and on. We talk about so many of these creatures. And given that you have written so many books about such a wide range of incredible animals and birds, for example, what are your thoughts about this? Because we're having a conversation about climate change, but we need to spend more attention about how climate change is affecting the creatures that so many of us have come to really love and appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think of it, they're our family. It's easy to look into the face of like a chimpanzee and realize you can share a blood transfusion with a chimp, but we share 90% of the genetic material with all mammals, and we share 40% of our genetic material with a banana. So isn't that cool?
It's cool.
So we are not just poisoning our yard. We are poisoning our families. We are poisoning our planet. And sometimes you just feel like despairing when you see, you know, they're calling it the insect apocalypse. We're killing the insects. I mean, we think of them as hard to kill, but we're actually killing off insects. We are polluting the oceans so badly that by the year 2050, there's going to be more plastic in the ocean than fish. Mm. But what gives me hope at a time like that, and boy, after this very difficult year with the pandemic, everyone I think is hungry for hope, is one, if we could do the superhuman job of raising two orphan baby hummingbirds, something that's even hard for mother hummingbird, well, then maybe we can save our sweet green world. And the other thing that's giving me hope is what Brenda is doing now. The hummingbirds have led her to expand her circle of compassion beyond these beautiful birds that everyone loves to all pollinators. And she's working on this fantastic project, Yampa Path. And maybe you'd like to talk about that a little, Brenda.
Yes, I think one of the wonderful things of being at WildCare in San Rafael and working with them with the hummingbirds was Mrs. Twilica, the lady that started Wild Care and all of that was really into educating children and about wildlife and about the birds and all the little creatures. And she was really, she really stressed the whole thing about the network, that we're not there. It's not one species. You can have your favorite bird, but you got to realize that that bird relies on certain plants and certain other little creatures and bugs and all of that to be able to survive. And that network is really critical now, and even more critical, I think, with the pollinators, because it affects our so many of our foods and we just won't have them if we don't have our bees and our butterflies and our hummingbirds and our bats all out there doing their thing. And I think up here, my husband and I bought this land up here, and I always wanted to have an arts center, but I realized I couldn't, when I retired from doing the hummingbirds. It's like you never retire. It's like they were always there, you know, and I just couldn't abandon them. And so I got into the pollinator gardens more, and the seasonal changes and how that all affects the hummingbirds, but all the pollinators. And then I'm in California, and the devastating droughts and the fires. It really shook me up terribly. It still does. I don't know how these guys are going to survive if we just don't step up the taking care of them better, taking care of the habitats and their place in our world. And so we decided to really make one of the centerpieces for the sculpture path as a pollinator garden. And so I've been working with some of the Paiute Native Americans up here, and they just really love hummingbirds. It's like they almost become a hummingbird when they're working. It's like the way they kind of flit around, and they're trying to develop this path. And we have a lot of petroglyphs up here, and that big spiral thing is a very important spiritual symbol for them, and it comes from nature. I don't know and their mythology and all of that, but it's really kind of exciting. And if we manage to pull this off and actually get this really going, it will be really, really kind of fantastic, because it's an important area. We're getting a lot more kind of unusual birds kind of migrating through here, because the fires have changed, their feeding ground so much for the birds. It's like they're kind of trying to find better places and stuff. So, but anyways, that's what we're working with.
Well, I was so impressed that, you know, you were telling me, Brenda, how, you know, by creating pollinator gardens, you actually can generate microclimatic ecosystems. And I went looking on the internet for some stuff about this and found this University of Singapore researcher in a paper in Global Change Biology confirming that even small areas have, and I'll quote from his paper, have extraordinary potential to buffer climate change and likely reduce mortality during extreme climate events. So these carefully chosen communities of plants can really counter some of the damage from climate change and provide little oases for animals, even during these cataclysmic fires, even in the face of climate change.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I read about this this guy in India, and who just started planting trees, and he just planted trees and trees and more trees, and now he has a huge forest, and he actually changed the climate in that area for, and all these animals and birds just came, and it's now it's an important resource for that part of India for wildlife. And actually, I think that's kind of what really reading about his experience over the years doing that, I thought, well, and we are right on the edge of where the high desert and the mountains kind of come together. It's like they overlap, and overlapping habitats are great for wildlife. And, you know, we have antelope bouncing through the property every once in a while. It's like really exciting. And I'm hoping that we can do something really like that. And the hedgerows are very, very important because they're trees and bushes. They're pollinator hedgerows. And who doesn't want a dogwood in their backyard? They're beautiful. I mean, they're, you know, they, you know, for an art thing, I can't wait to be out there to draw them or paint them. It's very needed here. We were lucky. We got a small grant from the NRCS, the National Resource Conservation Service, and they are concentrating on pollinator people doing pollinator gardens and working basically with the farmers, trying to get them to designate an area to do pollinator gardens and plant hedgerows. And they're helping pay for our irrigation system because we need water. And we have to put in an irrigation system to have it, have our pollinator garden and our hedgerows. And they also provide a lot of educational and I mean one-on-one. I mean, this gal, she comes out here and she just walks me through and shows me all these things that I need to do and how to plant things where I'm not disturbing the soil too much and getting a lot of crappy things. And so that's exciting.
You know, it's so important to hear these stories at a time when we're learning so much about the climate crisis. And I just, we're going to take calls in just a minute. We're almost out of time. But Brenda, did I hear you say that Mrs. Terwilliger started WildCare?
Yes, she did. She was. So
you brought up it's an amazing memory for me, because when I was in grade school, I went on a field trip with Mrs. Terwilliger to tide pools in Bodega Bay, and I became a huge ocean lover. My first book report was about a seashell, and then my second was about dolphins.
Yes,
I have such fond memories of her because it just opened my world. And then my mom just started taking us to the beach on a regular basis. And I think this just speaks to the importance of educating children. And I just went to the WildCare Facebook page, and WildCare is now offering in-person nature hikes for kids ages 7 to 11 this summer, starting June 28th. And again, they're based in San Rafael, California. So if you're in the area and you have kids in your life, definitely check this out. discoverwildcare.org/summer.
Yeah, I'm trained as a nature guide through WildCare and knew Mrs. Terwilliger too. She was just She was such an inspiration. I mean, she did so much. You should read about her life. She did so much all through. I mean, there would be no WildCare if it wasn't for her. And she also helped get property protected in the Bay Area, so it didn't get, all built up and stuff. She was just an incredible lady. Wow. And I'm hoping to have an educational program here for the children and also for adults in nature journaling, because I've taken some workshops and done some stuff with John Muir Laws and Jack Lucas and some other great people, where they've really stressed a lot about the network and the interaction that all these species have. It's so different now than it was when 10 years ago when Cy wrote about the baby hummingbirds, because it was like back then it was all kind of learning about these different species and these individual things. We seem to kind of not make the big connection like we are forced to do now because of climate change. And so it's really was exciting for me that the Hummingbird's Gift, the book came out, and we could tie it into the whole pollinator gardening scene, and how important and how all of that interacts is really a big deal.
Cy, you've written a number of books about children. In fact, Becoming a Good Creature is also on my list. I flipped through in the bookstore and it's so beautiful. Can you just briefly talk about the importance of these books for kids? Because the kids really get it.
Oh boy, you are so right. I mean, I like to say that the kids, they're not the leaders of tomorrow. They're often the leaders of today. And they actually do drive a lot of decisions in the home. Children often are educating their parents about environmental kinds of issues. And God bless them, you know, they haven't bought the lie yet that life is about accumulating more and more stuff. They know that it's about connection. That's the true love. So I've always written for kids as well as adults, and I've got at least 20 books for kids out, and the latest of them is Becoming a Good Creature. It's a memoir, really, but a picture book with Rebecca Green's gorgeous, tender drawings. And it introduces children to some animals in my life who were there for me while I had to make some crucial decisions or when I was facing some difficult choices. For example, it was my first dog, Molly, at age 3. Who showed me what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. What I wanted to do was basically be an apprentice to Molly and learn what she knew. It was 3 emus, giant flightless Australian birds who I studied in the outback when I was in my early 20s, who showed me the path to my career, which was literally following wild animals in their footsteps. And ermine, a kind of weasel, showed me how to forgive. An octopus showed me that no matter how different you are from someone else, if you have no bones, for example, or if you breathe water, as octopuses do, if you can taste with all of your skin and pour your baggy boneless body through an opening the size of an orange, even though you're 4 feet long, you can still be my friend. So animals have these great lessons to teach us. And particularly in a year that it turned out many children could not find a teacher in the classroom because they couldn't go to the classroom. It was very exciting for them to hear that teachers are all around us and that sometimes they've got 2 legs, but sometimes they have 4 or 6 or 8 or none in the case of snakes. And sometimes they have fins and feathers. And one of my greatest teachers was a pig, big fat pig. And that wasn't an insult. He really was a big fat pig.
Well, the work that you do is so, so amazing. And, you know, thank you for bringing all of these creatures out to the world and really giving people a newfound respect for an animal like a pig. I love that. And Brenda, thank you so much. It was great to meet you in the book and great to have you on the show. We'd actually love to do a show about wild care to learn more about the work that you and all of your colleagues do there.
Oh, that would be great. Wild care. You know, I really have to plug in people. We really need volunteers. Wild Care needs volunteers. We need volunteers up here at Yampa. And you don't have to know a lot. I mean, you'll learn by, you know, being part of something that you just have a little bit of an interest in, or that you just something you care about.
We will definitely do a show about that, because I'm sure once we get out again, which we are starting to do that, people would love to volunteer. Brenda Sherburn-Labelle is a hummingbird rehabilitator. Cy Montgomery is the author of The Hummingbird's Gift, Wonder, Beauty, and Renewal on Wings, and 20 other amazing books. Find more information about Cy and Brenda's incredible work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.